Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. A zoonosis, or a zoonotic disease, is a disease that can be transmitted to humans from other animals. That's how H1N1 started, but it's not the first. Mad cow disease, rabies, E. coli, Lyme disease, and the bubonic plague are all zoonotic. Killers like HIV and Ebola probably started out in animals, too. And on a planet with more people, livestock, and pets than ever, we may have more to look forward to. This hour on Point, from animals to humans, diseases making the leap. You can join the conversation. Has H1N1 made you wonder about how diseases pass between animals and humans? When your cat sneezes, do you run? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from New York City is Donald G. McNeil, Jr. He's a science and health reporter for The New York Times. Donald McNeil, thanks for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
So how is H1N1 shaping up this flu season?
Here in New York City, we had a big wave in the spring. There's a possibility that 10% of the city was infected. It quieted down in the summer. It, of course, spread across the country in the spring. It quieted down over the summer, although it hit summer camps. And now it's having a big second wave that started in the southeast, down in Georgia, and then has spread across the country. And different parts of the country live in different amounts of fear in it. But the virus hasn't changed. It's still makes lots and lots of people sick, and if it's a typical pandemic virus, that'll eventually reach between a third and a half of the world, but very few of those people end up hospitalized, and very few of those end up dying.
So second wave, you said, eventually might reach large numbers of people. Right now, do we have numbers? Do we know percentage-wise per state population?
I've forgotten now the last time what the CDC's estimate was, but it's many millions of people have been infected in the United States now, and some have had such mild cases they barely noticed, and some have had severe cases, and some have died.
How virulent is it turning out to be, generally speaking? Is it as dangerous as people feared? You say some are not as sick, but others certainly are.
It's not well, it's hard to say this in a simple way. The difference between it and seasonal flu is it tends to attack the young. That is, the young tend to catch it, whereas right. With seasonal flu, 90% of those people who die are over 65. With this flu, it's unusual, and it scares people. It scares parents and stuff because it blows through kindergartens and blows through grammar schools quite quickly, and you see a lot of kids get sick. Most of them get over it the same way you get over a bad cold. You know, you stay home, you rest, get plenty of fluids, and go back to school in a few days. A very small number get seriously ill. Two-thirds of them are, you know, have some underlying health problems, but one-third of them are perfectly healthy kids. So, I mean, the overall mortality is nobody knows yet, but it may end up being lower than seasonal flu. But, of course, presumably later in the flu season, we'll have both seasonal flu and swine flu circulating at the same time, and that will add to the death total.
And what about the vaccination effort, Donald? Why is it still so hard to get a vaccine?
But remember, there's two different vaccines. There's the seasonal vaccine, which they made the same amount by May as they made last year, about 114 million doses, and then they had to stop making that so they could use the chickens and the eggs and the purification factories and everything else for making the swine flu vaccine. Mm-hmm. The swine flu vaccine is growing very slowly, much more slowly than they expected when they did the initial tests on it, and so it's coming out really slowly. I think there's been too much has been made of the idea that the government predicted 120 million doses by now, and there's only 40 million doses. It's more like one federal official was being over-optimistic, and reporters picked it up. There were no firm promises, but there's less vaccine than they hoped for, and the fact that it's growing slowly is very frustrating to the government, to the companies.
And to the people. I mean, there were also reports that you might need a second dose of the vaccine. Is that still true?
Only those under 10 years old might need a second dose. And that's typical with regular flu vaccines. Young kids who've never had a flu shot before and have never had the flu, the first dose acts as a primer and the second dose acts as a booster. And then after that, every time you get a flu shot, you just need one.
Speaking of the vaccine, I wanted to ask you about that story that came out recently about the Wall Street firms, Goldman Sachs and Citigroup, buying up swine flu vaccine for their employees. Drew some criticism that this vaccine, so hard to find, is going first to the privileged or those who can most afford it. What does your reporting reveal on that?
I just think that's completely overblown. I mean, the Goldman Sachs has 8,700 employees in New York. They have a perfectly legitimate employee health clinic, and they got 200 doses. If you've got 8,700 people, you probably do have 200 people who are pregnant or have an infant under 6 months at home, who have diabetes or asthma, and it's not necessarily the bankers. I mean, if this vaccine was all going to the 200 highest earners, that would be a scandal and a travesty. But if it's going to people, I mean, there's a banker who lives on my block in Brooklyn, and I told him, you know, you should get the vaccine because he has a 3-week-old baby at home, and the baby can't get the vaccine. So you're not giving the vaccine to the banker to protect the banker. You're giving the vaccine to the banker to protect the new baby, and that's a good thing from a public health point of view.
Well, Donald McNeil, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donald McNeil, Jr. is a science and health reporter for The New York Times. Joining me now to talk about H1N1 and beyond that, zoonotic diseases generally, from Columbus, Ohio, is Lonnie King. He's dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, former director of the National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases at the Center for Disease Control. Lonnie King, thank you very much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hello, Jane. You're welcome.
And from Oklahoma City, we're joined by Susan Little. She's a professor of veterinary parasitology at the Center for Veterinary Health Sciences at Oklahoma State University, also a member of the board of directors of the Companion Animal Parasite Council, which is sponsoring the Pets, People, and Pathogens Conference in Providence, Rhode Island, next week. Susan Little, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Jane. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you. Lonnie King, let me ask you first, define for us, what is a zoonotic disease?
Pretty simply, Jane, it's those diseases transmitted from or through animals to people.
And give us a range of the different diseases that are, in fact, zoonotic.
Well, there's quite a large range, actually, if you think about bacteria, viruses, rickettsia, prions, parasites, fungal or mycotic diseases, all of these are major groups, and within these there are dozens of pathogens that are zoonotic.
And so give us the science of this, from the avian flu to H1N1 to ringworm and West Nile virus. I mean, how exactly do these diseases jump from animals where they start and incubate to humans?
Well, they have different mechanisms to do that, and the National Academy of Sciences, the Institute of Medicine, talks about the perfect microbial storm. The conditions are just right for these different pathogens to have special opportunities to transfer from animals to people. Some of that transfer is just direct, like rabies or anthrax. Some of it may be indirect, that we'd get through our food sources, like E. coli, or through water, like Giardia. Others are transmitted through what we call vectors. That might be mosquitoes that transmit West Nile or ticks that transmit Lyme disease. And then as these organisms adapt, they will move from animals to humans and then actually take characteristics that they'll move from human to human to human.
Hmm. And so are there certain factors or certain conditions that have changed now or in the past decades that make it more likely for these dangerous zoonotic diseases to arise? It just seems like we're hearing more about them.
I think it's the convergence of humans and animals and animal products. So the organisms are given opportunities that they've not really had before. But we see, you know, changes in human behavior, where we have, you know, pushing 7 billion people on the face of the earth. They travel more. This year, more than 1 billion people will cross international lines during travel. Trade of products. Agriculture is between $2 and $3 trillion industry as part of a major global food system. Our ecosystems are changing, so vectors can adapt and change. But I think it's this international travel, trade, and commerce, and the movement of people, animals, and products, and vectors that are unprecedented. We've seen this before, but we've not seen it in the opportunities that are created today for the human-animal interface.
And so, Susan Little, put this into perspective for us, even beyond that. Are these new zoonotic diseases more dangerous than other diseases in the past?
Well, I don't know if they're more dangerous. I mean, we've had rabies for quite a while, and it does carry an almost guaranteed fatality rate when it jumps into people as well as in animals. And so we've known about highly virulent zoonotic pathogens for a while, but we're finding more of them due to the, as Dr. King explained, due to the interface between the animals and the people.
Are the incubation periods necessarily faster in a zoonotic disease, Susan Little?
No, it would really depend more on the pathogen and the characteristics of the pathogen. In fact, some of the viruses, because they have a few days of incubation before disease is produced, that allows international travel to occur and then rapid spread. And we certainly saw that with the SARS outbreak, where it was in 5 countries within 24 hours.
So the species hopping gets on an airplane and travels with the folks to different parts of the world, and that's why it travels so quickly.
Exactly. And there are some zoonoses, you know, that move from animals to people and then don't transmit people to people. Toxoplasmosis in cats, for example. And so you'd have the parasite shed in the feces of cats and then people ingest it. Or more commonly, people ingest undercooked meat that has the parasite in it. They become sick, but they're not going to pass it on to someone else. And that's different than a viral infection that makes the leap from an animal to a person and then can transmit person to person. That's when you get pandemics.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about zoonotic diseases, diseases which can pass from animals to humans. We're joined this hour by Lonnie King, Dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, and by Susan Little, Professor of Veterinary Parasitology at Oklahoma State University. We have plenty of calls here. Let's get right to them. Leonard is in Newton, Massachusetts. Leonard, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello. I have a general comment about the training of medical and veterinary professionals to deal with zoonotic diseases. And in today's environment of highly specialization, that really makes it more difficult for communication to occur and for the individual veterinarian or physician to understand the background and epidemiology of these diseases. They're really not well trained in general biology or in epidemiology. And
Leonard, what's your background?
Properly, I think there's a need for increased education in medical and veterinary schools, and so I'd like their comments on that.
Well, let me ask you first, Leonard, what is your background?
I am both a veterinarian and physician. Both of your guests actually know me, and I know them. And I've worked in zoonotic diseases in academia, government, and private practice.
All right, Leonard, thank you. What about the training of medical professionals, both veterinary and human physicians, in working with zoonotic diseases? Lonnie King, you first.
That's a great question, and Leonard, thank you for that, and it's good to hear from you. I would agree with Leonard in terms of new professionals need to have new skills and knowledge to be successful in this interconnected world of human and animal health that cross over. Frankly, I think veterinarians get probably better training than physicians in this regard. Our students at Ohio State, and I'm sure at Oklahoma State, where Dr. Little is, have courses in population medicine and food safety and epidemiology and parasitology and foods and zoonoses, and so they're fairly well prepared. I think when they become professionals in public health, they move on and get MPH degrees or more training. Physicians do the same thing, but physicians tend to be trained more with individual people or parts of systems of people, and the idea of population health and looking at disease spread in large populations is something that I think they learn after that training.
So, Susan Little, how do doctors and veterinarians currently monitor and control zoonotic diseases?
Well, there's certainly monitoring that goes on through the Centers for Disease Control, and the Epidemiologic Investigative Service always has veterinarians in their training program for disease outbreaks. We have veterinarians in place in state agricultural labs around the country, but also in public health labs. So every state will have a public health veterinarian that oversees that and often works with zoonotic infections, but also vector-borne diseases, because those are usually zoonotic in nature. But Dr. Marcus was, you know, exactly on that we do need better training and more integrated training. And that's, you know, the purpose of this upcoming conference with the Rhode Island Veterinary Medical Association, Pets, Pathogens, and People, is to achieve that after graduation, because we certainly do it in veterinary college. We spend a lot of time in the curriculum on zoonoses. It's in the mission statement of veterinary medicine to protect public health as well as animal health. But then we have to do it after graduation. We have to provide those continuing education opportunities to physicians and veterinarians to allow them to come together and share their expertise.
Are there certain hosts, certain kinds of animals that are more likely to generate a disease that's dangerous to people? Lonnie King?
One of the things we're, you know, realizing more and more is the role of wildlife. They continue to be, I think, very important vectors and carriers of zoonotic diseases. So I remember waking up one morning, either 2001 or 2002, and in the United States, we had SARS, we had monkeypox, and we had West Nile virus. None of these three had ever been in the Western Hemisphere in history. And we wake up one morning, find all three of those diseases in the United States. SARS was probably carried in horseshoe bats and transmitted to other animals and eventually into humans. Monkeypox came in to the United States in a special tiny, an animal called a Gambian pouch rat that transmitted it to prairie dogs and then to people. And then West Nile is transmitted by mosquitoes, but it also affects birds, people, and horses. So wildlife becomes a very important part of our learning. Lyme disease, hantavirus are also important carriers of zoonotic diseases.
Is it just international travel that's at the top of the list here as being quite problematic, or do people generally have less resistance to these kinds of animal-transmitted diseases?
I think it's a combination of people being exposed like they haven't been exposed before, but there are characteristics today in human demographics that would suggest people may be more susceptible, and some of those reasons are that there's a large number of immunocompromised people today. If you think about the number of people involved with cancer therapy or organ transplants, there's a growing population of seniors. If you look in the United States, there's probably 90 million people that are part of a wave of people coming in the United States that are approaching their retirement years that may all be immunocompromised to a certain degree later on in life. So, and then there's poverty worldwide when we think about right. these 6.5 to 7 billion people with poor nutrition and parasitism that renders them more susceptible. So because of that susceptibility and because of the opportunities to be exposed more, we see a higher rate of transmission.
Let's go to Billy now. He's in Manomet, Massachusetts. Billy, welcome to On Point. Thanks for waiting.
How you doing?
Hi. Well, go ahead.
Well, I was just referring to when you said this cat sneezing on you, or do you run? And, you know, of course, we have a cat, and it recently bit my youngest son. He's 17 months old, and he ended up getting, like, an infection on his leg, so we took him to the pediatricians immediately. And they put him on an antibiotic, and luckily, within, like, 3 days, it already scabbed up and healed up. But we were kind of stressing out because all this stuff with the H1N1 and, you know, how cats are real dirty. They go in the litter box, and, you know, they are indoor cats, so we have two, a mother mm-hmm. and a little baby boy mm-hmm. cat left over from her kittens. But they play all the time in the litter box, and, you know, my youngest stepped on her tail, the mother, and she's, you know, pretty protective too, but she turned around and bit my son on his leg and drew blood, so.
Well, you know, it's a good point, Billy, and I'm glad everything worked out for you, but Susan Little, how do pets figure into this equation? I read recently the story of the cat in, where was it, Ames, Iowa, who was tested positively for H1N1, is that true?
Right, right, and the cat was infected from its owner, so it's sort of the reversed cycle that we usually think about. But, you know, house cats kept inside are in a closed system, and if humans in the home are coughing and have a respiratory illness, and it's a virus that's able to move from species between species as influenza viruses can, then in this case, it was confirmed that indeed it infected the cat. We do worry, though, about cat bites, as the caller described, and so I'm glad that they got quick pediatric care and that the lesion's resolving. And, you know, one of the things we can do, because kids and cats, there's going to be some bites, some scratches when those interactions occur. And so the best thing to do is make sure that the cats have regular veterinary care and that they're on parasite control products, that they're vaccinated. Certainly we want them vaccinated to prevent things like rabies, you know, obvious diseases.
And beyond but those also, obvious diseases, what are some of the diseases we get from our pets?
Well, the parasitic diseases are a big focus. That's the focus of the Companion Animal Parasite Council. And, you know, a cat having fleas is uncomfortable for the cat, uncomfortable for the family because the fleas will jump to the people. But it also makes the cats more likely to be infected with the agent of cat scratch disease, Bartonella. And so it creates a risk of infection in people with Bartonellosis if the cat bites or scratches a human if they're flea infested. Because the fleas transmit the bacteria to the cats, and then the cats transmit the bacteria to people.
And as the case in the Ames, Iowa cat, our pets are at risk from us as well.
Yeah, they are. And that's not a system we usually think about, but there's a few examples of that in parasitology, like giardiasis. When giardia was first identified in outbreak situations, there was a study in Colorado in the 1970s where they went in and looked for wildlife reservoirs of giardia. And at first they thought, oh, it's the beaver because the beaver were infected. Well, more surveys were done, and it was recognized that in pristine wilderness areas where there's not human impact, where there's not people, the beaver are not infected. So actually what was happening is people were infected, and they were transmitting it to animals.
Here's another call from Earhart, South Carolina. Beth is on the line. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jay.
Hi.
My question is regarding the HIV/AIDS virus.
Yes.
That I recall many, many years ago, People magazine did an investigative study story and found patient number one, they called him, that had been the first identified human to have contracted HIV. And he, to best of my remembrance, is that he had contracted it from a monkey or a baboon. And I was wondering how that took place, if he had been bitten or how that happened.
Beth, thank you. Lonnie King?
There's pretty good evidence that HIV/AIDS was a retrovirus that originated in subhuman primates. As a matter of fact, genetically, we've actually looked at that virus as it's evolved over time and have taken it backwards. And the likely origin was probably in a subprimate population in West Africa. The source of transmission would be unknown, but one of our concerns is are the number of hunters in Africa who are living off of wildlife, not only for their own food, but also for a burgeoning industry in foods that are distributed around the country for exotic types of foods. So this bushmeat is an area that we're CDC and others are looking at, and there are several studies going on where they're actually looking at these different hunters and actually taking serum samples from them to see if they continue to be exposed, and the HIV/AIDS, which for certain was a zoonotic disease in its origin but then has adapted to human-to-human, could actually happen again. And other retroviruses have actually been isolated from these hunters, which proves that this condition continues.
Mm. Here's another call from Columbia, South Carolina. Nancy is on the line. Nancy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Hi. I have a question based on parasites. With the health insurance, how people are not able to afford for specific screenings, how is someone to know, or a child, how is a doctor to know if a child is coming in with probably having hookworms in their intestines from an animal that they may be keeping at home, or an adult who may have hookworms in their brain or anywhere in their bodies that may be causing them considerable damage, migraine headaches or anything of that nature. Is that part of the screening that could be done for individuals in this country?
It's a good question, Nancy. Thank you very much. Lonnie King?
I might refer that to Dr. Littlejane. She's really the parasitologist.
Terrific. Susan Little?
Yeah, so there, you know, as part of a regular medical workup, we veterinarians always encourage physicians to ask about pet ownership and pet contact because we are concerned about parasites moving from animals to people. Now, the common zoonotic hookworms, the hookworms in dogs and cats that we try and control so people don't get infected, they pretty much cause a skin condition. It's called cutaneous larva migrans. The larvae in the environment from the feces of the pet will actually penetrate the skin and cause a rash. And in very occasional rare cases, they'll go to the small intestine. But they don't really migrate through the body. Nonetheless, a dermatologist would be very adept at recognizing that lesion. A family practitioner would recognize it and then treat appropriately. So I do think that the screening is in place, and there's growing awareness of how to diagnose parasites when they move from animals to people.
I'm just curious how you can tell that the parasite has actually come from a pet and not from something else.
Right. And certainly there are human hookworms and there are human roundworms. And so we have to be concerned about that. But the infection pressure is relatively low in people in most of the U.S. And so when we see that classic skin lesion, that migration tract from a larval hookworm, it's very distinct in how it presents. And then if it responds to the therapy, then you have a good conclusion.
Lonnie King, zoonotic diseases are remarkably adaptive, are they not?
They're very adaptive. These organisms will cross species lines readily, and they are consistently looking for a niche to survive. We've just now, because of our interconnected world, given them more opportunities to survive and more niches for them to invade. Right now, about we know of maybe over 1,400 different human pathogens, and 60% of those are what we would call multi-species pathogens. In other words, they would cross species lines. In the last 30 years, 75% of all new human infections have been zoonotic. So you can see that the world is more and more being involved with zoonoses is part of our interconnectivity.
You think about the swine flu and the avian flu being obvious zoonotic diseases, but I was also interested to hear that E. coli is essentially a zoonotic disease as well, is it not?
I think this idea of indirect transmission of pathogens, and many of our foodborne pathogens are indeed transmitted from animals and animal species to people through food or through water. So E. coli, Campylobacter, Listeria are some common pathogens that we see that are transmitted through our food supply.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking this hour about zoonotic diseases, diseases that pass from animals to humans. We're joined this hour by Lonnie King, Dean of the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine, and by Susan Little, Professor of Veterinary Parasitology at Oklahoma State University. Right back to the phones now. Ted is first up in Idaho Falls, Idaho. Ted, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
Hello. My question involves, what can we do to sort of break this cycle? What should be done with the feces of animals as long as humans continue to live with and raise and to grow and to eat animals? There is a risk for other pathogens from the feces, from the carcasses, the animals that die. Currently, those animals are being dumped in landfills or incinerated. What do you think should be done? And I think that there is something that should be done.
Ted, thank you. Susan Little, how do we break the cycle?
Yeah, that's the really key question, because that's our goal, of course, is to stop the cycle. And, you know, every parasitologist, every infectious disease person will tell you cook your meat and wash your hands. That certainly protects the individual. But in terms of breaking the cycle on an environmental level, the caller specifically asked about animal feces, and we do certainly recommend pet feces should not be composted. It should be disposed of in a landfill. That's not something we usually think about, but it needs to be somehow contained. If it's composted and then spread in a garden, or if it's just sort of left to decompose, then there's the risk of keeping those zoonotic agents cycling in nature. Mm-hmm. If it's removed from the environment and disposed of in a contained way, then there's a level of safety that's achieved. But agricultural production is a whole nother level because of the amount of feces that's produced. And it's an entire area of research unto itself. There's a lot of effort put forth into making sure that there's not a risk of infection from animal feces.
Here's a question on that very point from Ellen in Mendon, Massachusetts. Ellen, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. I think my concern over the last few years was avian flu and now swine flu. And if there is any correlation between the intensive factory farming we do here in the United States and those kind of diseases.
What about factory farming and the impact on avian flu and swine flu and the other things, Professor King?
I wouldn't worry so much in the United States as I worry what's happening in developing countries. When we think of influenzas, in veterinary medicine, we think of four kinds. What we call low pathogenic influenzas, which are transmitted all the time, especially between domestic and wild birds. There's a high pathogenic strain like H5N1 was, which was has high case fatality rates in birds. And then when they switch over, you have seasonal flu and pandemic flu in people, and also pandemics in animals. So what we see worldwide is a phenomenal increase in the demand for protein from animal sources. The Food and Agriculture Organization has projected that there will be a 50% increase in the demand for protein from animal sources in the year 2010. Hmm. Right now, last year, we produced worldwide 22 billion food animals to help feed between 6 and 7 billion people. If we project forward another decade and think about another 10 billion animals in that system, we're going to have continuing problems of this opportunist of zoonotic diseases. So the
So to the previous caller's point, then, how do you break the cycle? I mean, of these zoonotic diseases, what do you say?
So one is learning more about the transmission, which are certainly researchable issues. I think the idea of raising animals in ways with greater biosecurity and greater safety is certainly possible and being done in some parts of the world. The cycle is going to be very difficult to break in developing countries where 90% of the world's population is increasing.
Right.
So they increase in animals and animal products in those parts of the world, then create an environment for this transmission to take place, and the rest of the world can be exposed very, very quickly.
Here's a call from Boston. Jenny is on the line. Thanks so much for waiting. Jenny, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering about Lyme disease. My dad got Lyme disease in the 80s. He got really sick, and they didn't know much about it, so it was never diagnosed as Lyme. But like 5 years ago, he got extremely sick, and he saw every doctor you could imagine. And after seeing three Lyme specialists, he was diagnosed with chronic inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy, and caused from the Lyme disease. And we've had many dogs and horses over the years, and it's always been part of their yearly checkup to be tested for Lyme, but it seems to be a lot more difficult to diagnose it in humans, or it's not as common to check people for it. Is there any reason for that?
Jenny, thank you very much. Susan Little, you are an expert on Lyme disease, the perfect person to answer Jenny's question.
Well, and I am a veterinarian rather than a physician, and so the question's related to human disease, but I'll try and address it. It can be challenging to diagnose Lyme disease in people, and it requires a clinician that's familiar with the condition, which most physicians in endemic areas are, and then, you know, specific and sensitive diagnostic tests. We do routinely screen dogs for Lyme disease. There are differences in how we manage Lyme disease in dogs and in people. It's very common to test dogs annually for exposure to Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative agent, and then consider the possibility for disease so that we can institute early treatment. But that's just not the approach to management in people. And, you know, what's really key, certainly early detection of disease is important, but preventing Lyme disease requires a lot of effort on trying to prevent tick bites. And there's so many other tick-borne diseases out there as well. And so you really need a comprehensive approach to tick-borne disease control.
Is it passed solely through ticks, the disease, from animals to people?
That's the only recognized route is ticks. And it's ticks that fed on wildlife, rodent, reservoir host in their immature stage and then have molted and are now feeding on a person or on a dog. And so dogs develop Lyme disease, but they aren't a source of the infection to the ticks or to the family.
And I have read, Professor Little, that Lyme disease seems to be becoming more widespread, especially in the South. Is that true?
Well, certainly cases are increasing. We have on average about 20,000 human cases in the United States reported every year, and last year was pushing 30,000, so the numbers are going up. And the endemic areas for Lyme disease transmission are increasing. They used to be in fairly focal areas in the Northeast and Upper Midwest, and there's been a slow spread eastward around the Great Lakes up into the Lower Peninsula of Michigan, and then apparently, too, down the Atlantic seaboard as well. But I wouldn't say that I haven't seen evidence of transmission to people or dogs in the Deep South, in the southern U.S.
Why the spread generally, would you say?
Well, what we think is happening is that we're reaching, we're basically breaking a threshold for transmission. It's an area of active research. We don't really know the central mechanism for the spread. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to have the rodent reservoirs, you have to have the tick vectors, and then you have to have the bacteria, the Borrelia burgdorferi bacteria, and they all have to communicate in nature. And really, when we have low biodiversity, when we have just a few rodent species left, usually due to human disturbance, due to development, then if those few rodents that are left are good reservoirs for the bacteria, then a whole lot of the ticks are infected. And so the risk of infection is greater. And we think that's what's happening.
Here is Dolores now calling from Hamburg, New York. Dolores, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for the courtesy. I had two questions. One was relative to the Hunter virus in terms of symptoms and its transmission, and I thought that came from mice or rats, but I was thinking about the feces of mice in the house. Even they've been running around, and before you catch them, they're kind of unwanted pets, as it were. Mm-hmm. And then the other question I had was relative to the immunization of wildlife by way of feed that would be put out for them to prevent them from getting the diseases to transmit this to humans. Mm. If you could speak to those two points, please.
Dolores, thank you very much. Professor King, what about the second point first? Wildlife, immunizing animals through feed.
Well, there's some really excellent research being done, immunizing not only wildlife for maybe certain diseases, but also in terms of preventing their reproductive capabilities, so we don't see these huge populations of white-tailed deer and rodents and other types of wildlife. So there's some really good research taking place there. There's some cutting-edge research in, for example, looking at a disease like Lyme, where we were unsuccessful having a vaccine for humans. Now we're taking a look with some private companies in the CDC of actually being able to reproduce the protein characteristics that cause an antibody response, and putting it in a food like rice, where that antibody then would be expressed in rice, and rice could be then spread in large areas, eaten by rodents, and who would develop an immunity then to the Lyme organism and then break the cycle.
And you think that would have a large impact?
It could possibly have a large impact, and the same thing might actually happen in Usurnia in Africa with plague. So this is an active area of research, and it's because of the rapid changes in biotechnology that allows us to express these proteins in foods that can be manufactured much cheaper and spread in larger areas.
And Professor Susan Little, Dolores's first caller comment was about the hantavirus. She's wondering if it comes from mice and what are the symptoms of hantavirus, another zoonotic disease.
Right, right. And that first emerged, of course, in the Four Corners area in the southwestern U.S., which is where we recognized it. And it is associated with rodents and exposure to rodent dropping, rodent urines. And so limiting rodents around human habitation, around homes, is really important to prevent it. And it causes respiratory disease, of course.
Ben is now on the line from Crossville, Tennessee. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is kind of an odd one probably that you'll get today, but if someone like myself suffers really bad with OCD, you know, and germs are just the biggest fear in the world that I have, and I live in a country area, so there are dead animals on the roads or on the sides of the roads or just all over the place from being hit by cars or what have you, or dying just on their own. Are there chances just walking past or driving past of getting some of these things, diseases and what have you, through the airborne air that we breathe? Things, you know, bad diseases, I wonder if they can travel through the air if you're close enough to a dead animal to contract any of these horrible diseases.
It's a good question, Ben.
My answer off the air.
Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. Professor King?
Well, I appreciate Ben's problem and very sympathetic, and I understand he's, you know, goes through life with, you know, a special burden. Biosecurity and you know, how do you protect yourself is real important, and I'm sure he has a strategy with his physician in terms of how to do that. I would be less concerned about kind of walking by dead animals or animals have been killed in the road and have an aerosol transmission there, and that would be a very, very rare occurrence. I'd be more concerned with Ben in terms of foodborne illnesses or waterborne illnesses that may be more direct contact or directly involved with contacts with animals. So he would have to have kind of a special attention to do that. But I wouldn't be very concerned about contracting a disease from dead animals that he would just be walking by.
Ben, thanks so much for the call. Here's Brandon in Ledyard, Connecticut. Brandon, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hello. I was curious about what precautions by law zoos, aquariums, and other zoological facilities need to take to protect their visitors from any of the diseases you're talking about today.
Mm. Brandon, thanks. Professor Little, any comments about that? Precautions at aquariums or zoos? Are we at particular risk?
Yeah, we are, and that's a great question. I think, actually, zoos and aquariums do a really good job of trying to manage the risk. We're very familiar, veterinarians are familiar with petting zoos and the risk of infection to small children. You know, young kids love young animals, but it's a bad combination in terms of transmission of zoonotic diseases and infections. And so zoos screen their animals, especially if they're in touch exhibits, for infection routinely. You'll often see alcohol gels and hand washing stations so that as you leave the exhibit, you clean, you know, wash right away to prevent transmission of infection. It's important that children, especially young children under the age of 5, don't handle reptiles that might be a source of salmonella, like iguanas or certain turtle species. And so I think they're well informed about that, and well-managed larger exhibits are gonna make an effort to prevent the transmission from occurring.
Can't leave the topic of zoonotic disease without remembering foot and mouth disease, mad cow disease. I mean, how are those especially virulent and dangerous? And do you foresee something like that happening again, Lonnie King?
Well, foot and mouth disease is not really considered zoonotic. Technically is, but it really is a devastating virus that spreads throughout of the world and is present in still much of the world. We saw what happened in the United Kingdom and other parts of the world where you have this disease and the economic devastation that takes place. We haven't had foot and mouth disease in the United States since 1929, and we've gone to great lengths to prevent the occurrence, but we're always on edge about the incursion of a disease like foot and mouth disease and the huge economic devastation of our animal resources to try to get rid of it.
And Susan Little, the future of zoonotic diseases, what do you see? What's on the horizon? I mean, we're in the middle of swine flu season. We know all the others, avian flu, from rabies and hantavirus to Ebola. I mean, what do you see looking out on the horizon?
Well, you know, what makes it so fascinating and so frightening is that we don't know what's going to happen next. There were predictions about high pathogenic avian influenza, H5N1, and I think that's going to continue to be a concern, even as we write out the H1N1 epidemic that's ongoing. And so we know the pathogens are going to continue to evolve. I mean, that's how they survive, and they're going to continue to move between animals and people. So we just have to stay vigilant and respond.
Thank you very much for your time, both of my guests. Susan Little joining me from Oklahoma City, Professor of Veterinary Parasitology at the Center for Veterinary Health Sciences at Oklahoma State University. Professor Little, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Dean Lonnie King, Dean and Professor at the Ohio State University College of Veterinary Medicine. I appreciate your thoughts and insights, Professor. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. I enjoyed being with you.
Thank you. You can continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us, as always, on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.